This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. According to local sources and the Indiana State Department of Health, there are 6 new positive cases of COVID-19 virus noted here in the state. And of those cases reported, 3 have been confirmed here in Northwest Indiana as of this morning. 2 of them in Lake County, and a 55-year-old LaPorte County man who is now being treated at the Porter Regional Hospital in Valparaiso. One of the cases from Lake County is reported at the community hospital in Munster, and another is being reported by Methodist Hospital South Lake campus, and the first patient reported at the hospital there. According to Evelyn Morrison, who is the healthcare systems manager of marketing and corporate communications, the patient went to the emergency room at the South Lake campus with the signs, and then was later tested as being positive for COVID-19. Patient's been assessed, placed in isolation, and is now in stable condition. And Morrison says that Methodist Hospitals is following the CDC guidelines, and they're staying in touch with the State Department of Health to make sure that they are ready as the case continues on. They also say they have the steps to adequately have an inventory of personal protective equipment and operating supplies on hand at the hospitals, as well as cleaning and disinfectant products as well. The other cases around the state have been in various places. We also know, too, that there's now a second death reported today, result from the COVID-19 illness. One case that we mentioned in the newscast earlier was reported from central Indiana in the Indianapolis area. And the second case that has now been announced as reportedly death is a resident of Johnson County, south of Indianapolis. Both of the cases in central Indiana were adults over the age of 60. And the latest victim reported was a Johnson County person who had been hospitalized as well. There have been now 13 counties in Indiana that have reported positive COVID-19 cases. Thousands of workers at Indiana's casinos are left to wonder now if they'll get paid after all the gambling operations have been shut down in response to the COVID-19 illness. Here's Michael Puente with more on that.
Indiana's 14 casinos are closed at least for the next 2 weeks. Caesars Entertainment, whose casinos include Horseshoe and Hammond outside Chicago, has the means to pay employees now. But Ed Feigenbaum, who writes about the gambling industry in Indiana, says that may not be a long-term solution.
Caesars Entertainment just tapped into the entire credit line that they've got left. Basically, you know, their equivalent of draining the teller machine.
Four Winds Casino in South Bend, operated by a Native American group, says it will continue to pay its employees. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Michael Puente.
From time to time, we like to keep track of what is happening as far as recycling and the like in Porter County is concerned, and here's our opportunity to ask Ron Taylor about that. Ron works with the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District, and thank you for joining us on this program today, Ron.
Hi, Chris. Great to be here.
Well, let's start first with the big list, I guess. And there's some other topics, too, I'd like to try and cover as well. But one of the major things coming up that people should, when you're working on putting things on your calendar at home, is when the next household hazardous waste collection day might happen to be in your neighborhood. And the list just came out, I guess, going into 2020. Fill us in where they're going to be and what days they're going to be set up for.
Okay, so yeah, we have quite a few spread throughout the year. The first is going to be Saturday, May 2nd from 9 a.m. to 2 at the Porter County Expo and Fairgrounds. There's another one Saturday, June 13th at Portage High School, Saturday, June 27th at Westchester Intermediate School, Saturday, July 18th at Couch Middle School, Saturday, August 1st at Portage High School, and Saturday, October 10th at the Porter County Expo and Fairgrounds. And that's our last one for the year.
Mm-hmm. I understand these are very well received, regardless of where they happen to be.
Yes, absolutely. It's a great resource for people. It's one of the few opportunities to get rid of all those chemicals. You may not even know what they are, just gathering dust in the basement. It's a great way to responsibly get rid of those items.
Now, the big list, by the way, is listed on the Porter County Recycling and Waste Production District website. But as you mentioned, there's these are things that typically just end up being in somebody's basement or garage, and they some of them are relatively harmless, but some of them really aren't. Give us an idea, just what some of these hazardous waste materials that I guess you can, I guess you officially call them that, but they're certainly not but not benign to say the least. Some of it's pretty dangerous stuff, I guess, or could be.
Yes, absolutely. And the main thing is just making sure it doesn't end up down the drain or doesn't end up in any place where it can leach into the environment. So this can include any number of things, household solvents, cleaners, fertilizers, lawn care products, all sorts of things, aerosol cans, sprays, fuels, things of that nature. Anything that a household has that chemicals, anything that can be caustic, potentially dangerous, that's the kind of stuff we want to keep out of the environment. We want to keep out of the water table. We want to keep it from a landfill if possible. So those are the types of items that we're looking for.
Now, I understand that, that Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District has a contractor that actually does all the dirty work, so to speak, that helps get these items collected and properly disposed of. Tell us about the company and what kind of work that, that you have to work with them on in being able to set up these collection dates.
So that is a company called Tredebi, and they are licensed to do the kind of hazmat processing of these materials, basically, again, to just make sure they are disposed of properly. You know, it's a matter of identifying what the chemicals are, maybe what the potential hazards are, and you know, it's about following the state, federal regulations to make sure they're disposed of in a way so that they stay out of the environment.
Now, since you have different locations around the county, so it's convenient for everybody in Porter County to be able to make one of these dates that are set up, do you have to do the work on making sure that the right location fits for that particular spot, or do the contractors help work with you on that?
That's primarily handled through us. The contractors are more about processing the actual materials themselves, but we're very, very grateful for our staff, our new director, Carrie Mars Barone. Puts a tremendous amount of work in to coordinate with the locations to make sure that we have ample opportunities for people all across the county to have these events where it's convenient and it's accessible for people. So, yeah, we're tremendously grateful for our staff. They do a tremendous amount of work to set up these events so that the Porter County residents have this resource.
Now, we brought up the issue of dealing with the household hazardous waste on the collection days that are on the calendar for 2020. We have other days that go on the calendar, too, that people should be aware of, and a lot of it has to do with Mother Nature, and we're talking in this case about the composting operations. Bring us up to date where they are located in Porter County and some of the important dates that people need to know if they have cleanup in their yards or at their properties and where they can have that material dropped off.
Yeah, absolutely. So all of our compost sites are actually opening March 23rd for the season. We have three, the Valparaiso compost site at 2150 West Lincoln Way, the Boone Grove compost site at 546 South 400 West, and the Portage compost site at 6451 U.S. Highway 12. And those are another really fantastic resource because drop off yard waste, you can pick up mulch or compost. We have really high quality compost that's available at our sites, and it's a terrific opportunity to keep more materials out of the landfill, to just generate sustainable lawn care practices in Porter County residents. So we're really happy to have this resource. At Valparaiso and Broom Grove, you can also drop off electronics. Recycling, and that can include virtually anything with a cord. There's a really good exhaustive list, again, on our website of electronics items. That can include things like monitors, old keyboards, old computers, anything, old phones, all sorts of electronics items. We keep those out of landfills as well. You can take those during open hours. You can take those to our compost site. And currently, the drop-off recycling for household objects and items is also currently located at the 2150 West Lincoln Way, Valparaiso. Mm-hmm.
Well, probably the trash haulers in the area that support Porter County communities and businesses probably appreciate having this kind of drop-off site because they don't want to have that stuff mixed in with the trash.
Yeah. It really streamlines the whole thing. It's easy, much easier on their end. But yeah, absolutely. It relieves some of the pressure on those waste haulers.
We're talking with Ron Taylor with Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District about recycling issues in Porter County. We know that there have been problems in the past with the regular recycling drop-off locations. There were some that were shifted around for other reasons, one in particular, the one in Valparaiso on the off Highway 30 on the west edge of town. That was because of the wanting to have a different location at the request of the landowner, and you've worked
Correct.
That out. But there have been problems all along here, it seems, or at least within the recent years, about contamination of things that end up at the drop-off sites that aren't supposed to be there. We're still having
Correct.
Problems like that with the drop-off sites, or are things getting better?
Well, my understanding is things absolutely are getting better. Contamination is always an issue that we need to be on the lookout for. But, through education, fortunately, most people want to recycle properly, and all of our recycling programs really heavily depend on people taking the initiative to recycle properly. That's what sustains the whole thing. A little bit of contamination can ruin an entire load of recycling, and that makes it economically infeasible for the contractors that actually process the recycling, and that can threaten. And we see this all across the country, that can actually threaten recycling programs that municipalities and agencies maintain. So it really is critically important for us to make sure we're recycling properly, to reduce contamination. And a lot of residents, they absolutely want to do the right thing. It's just, unfortunately, sometimes there can be some misinformation out there, some misconceptions. That's why we always are available as a resource for people to find out what exactly can and can't be dropped off at those sites, what exactly can and can't be recycled. We have posters, all sorts of things available on our website. One of the big things is plastic bags. That's a recurring misconception people have. Sometimes they put their drop-off recycling or curbside recycling in plastic bags, which you can't do. They can be taken to any number of grocery stores throughout the county as long as they're clean and dry, even plastic film wrap, things of that nature. So that's one of the big misconceptions, along with just making sure things are clean, putting the bottle tops onto bottles, no greasy pizza boxes, or anything of that nature. So it's just really important. We want to prevent what we call wish cycling, when people really want something to be recyclable, and so they just put it right in the curbside bin or put it right in the drop-off bin, and that can cause serious problems. But fortunately, it looks like things are getting better, and that's what the whole process depends on.
Well, that's great to hear, Ron. I know coming up, it's going to be Earth Day. What kind of plans are the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District have to celebrate Earth Day this year?
Yeah, well, our big Northwest Indiana Earth Day celebration is April 18th, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's actually the 50th anniversary of the first Earth Day in 1970. So we're really, really excited about hosting a big event. We're going to have vendors and nonprofits, environmentally themed programs from around Northwest Indiana, all sorts of just about anything you can imagine related to sustainability, organic products, educational programs. We have the Silly Safaris are going to be there doing live animal presentations, the Dumpster Drummers who do this great music program. We have a gentleman who brings this really neat machine made out of recycled parts called the Recycle Cycle. So we're really excited about all the opportunities people are going to have to sort of engage with environmental themes and learn how to think about sustainability in their everyday lives. We're going to have a secure shred there that's going to help people dispose of sensitive documents safely and sustainably. So we're really excited about all the programs and all the vendors and everything we're going to have on offer this year.
Well, Ron, we'll be back in touch with you here getting closer to Earth Day and all the big events that are going to be planned here for Northwest Indiana's Earth Day celebration here in April. But for now, thank you very much for spending time with us to bring us up to date on what's been happening with the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District, and we'll have you back on again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And if I can just direct people to our website, portercountyrecycling.org, and also our Facebook page. You can just Facebook/RecyclePorterCounty. We're still open for any vendors with any kind of environmental focus, sustainability focus. They can sign up via our website. So we really appreciate you talking with us today.
Certainly. Thank you for that. And also, too, a reminder that PorterCountyRecycling.org is a place where you are not sure what you can recycle and where you can recycle it. And especially when it comes down to the household hazardous waste collection days, you go to the website and find out that information, too. Thank you for being with us today, Ron.
Thank you so much.
It's Ron Taylor. He's with the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District. And this is Regionally Speaking. With another edition of Building Northwest Indiana, here's Kevin Comerford.
Welcome to this episode of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. My name is Kevin Comerford. I am the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana, and I will be serving as your host today. The purpose of Building Northwest Indiana Radio is to give you a little insight into the Northwest Indiana professional construction industry. Today we're going to be talking about the West Lake Corridor Project, which is the southern branch extension of the existing South Shore Line that will run from Hammond to Dyer. And we're also going to be talking about the Double Tracking Project, which proposes to expand the South Shore Line from a single track to a double track, and that track runs between Gary and Michigan City. This is going to allow the South Shore Line to add trains for more frequent service, reduce delays, and improve travel times. So my guest today is going to be Bill Hanna. He is the president and CEO of the Regional Development Authority, also known as the RDA. So welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you. It's glad to be here.
Just to give our listeners a little insight into what the RDA does and what is your role there, can you provide our listeners with a little more insight into what you do and what is the purpose of the RDA?
Sure, absolutely. The RDA was formed back in 2005 and 2006, really, is when it started going. But it was a product of the Indiana General Assembly and then Governor Daniels. And it was a collaborative effort to put together an economic development group that focused on really assets that could be better developed, opportunities up here, and primarily an infrastructure investment. So we originally focused on development of the shoreline. And there's been several projects up there that people are familiar with, like the Whiting Lakefront Park or Gary Marquette or Wolf Lake Park, and one in Portage. And various others. We have a pretty good sized project going right now in East Chicago, as an example. Gary Airport, South Shore train assets, general economic development. So it really boils down to kind of natural assets for tourism and people moving in, ground transportation to and from Chicago, and connectivity to the rest of the state and the rest of the world. And those are the things that we focus on. And we're quasi-state, so we work closely with the governor's office and, as I said before, members of the General Assembly in Indianapolis.
So does the RDA only see redevelopment projects in Lake and Porter counties, or are you in LaPorte and St. Joe as well?
So we focus on Lake and Porter because those are where our members are, and we have local contributors from different municipalities and the county governments, and those are our partners, and they also have representatives on our board of directors. But since we're working on South Shore projects right now, the train projects, we're working in partnership with LaPorte County and St. Joe County as well. So we'll represent the two counties here in Lake and Porter, but there's a true partnership that's occurring between LaPorte County, St. Joe County, Porter, and Lake, which is, it's a newer thing, and it's been a great advancement to be able to form a four-county partnership in a state where those four counties constitute quite a large population center, and it gives us a lot of strength in General Assembly to be on the same page and asking for, assistance with projects that we all agree on.
Yeah, it seems like when local communities here in Northwest Indiana, including that four-county area you're talking about, get together, it really benefits the region as a whole. So it's good to see that LaPorte County and St. Joe County are collaborating as well with the RDA. Yeah. Well, speaking about the South Shore Line, let's start talking about the Westlake Corridor Project. I know that's a project that's coming down the pipeline. I'm not sure where we're at as far as funding is concerned. I just went to a presentation the other day that was for contractors, and it sounds like this project's going to be taken off here in the next year or two. Can you talk a little bit more about that project and maybe talk about a little bit of when that's supposed to get off the ground?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited about that one right now. It's been, we've been building these partnerships, and we've had great leadership going on and a lot of support from CAF and Dewey and Pierman, who leads that group, and trades representatives and others around Northwest Indiana. But it's been a long road, you know, and General Assembly coming together back in, you know, 15 to come up with funds for that project. After really, I think, you know, Congressman Visklosky being one, was pushing for this for over a couple decades. And so, you know, when you talk about a year or two away, it's I always feel like I should be reminding people about the scale, because that's almost lightning speed in terms of how these projects go. So we're right there. I expect that we'll be getting an entry into engineering designation, which is it's a term that the FTA uses to say that your funds or your efforts that you're undertaking right now are now reimbursable by the federal government. And here's the important part of that. In every case that I'm aware of where they received an entry into engineering designation, any project around the country like ours, they've always gone forward into a full project mode, with the exception of a couple where the governors of those particular states withdrew the projects on their own. So this is a major milestone, and we actually expect that any time here within the next 3 or 4 weeks. So we're right there. We could break ground in late summer next year. So what I'd like to see personally is some folks working on this project into, you know, the start of or actually the end of next year, what I would call boots on the ground. But, you know, folks from around here breaking ground.
Now, the Westlake Corridor, from what I could tell, is going to be 4 different stations running from the Hammond Gateway into the existing station that runs out to South Bend. But then it's going to also go down through Munster and through Dyer, and I think the end station is in Dyer. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, it's about 8 miles all told of new track that runs into the, you know, southern portion of Lake County.
And how many stations is it? Is it 4 stations?
Yes, and so yeah, and you're correct. The Hammond Gateway station is really an important one, because it that's where the existing South Shore meets the new line of the Westlake, and so. What that does for a rider is you could get on in Dyer and you could go all the way to South Bend or Chicago. So you could transfer at that point onto the South Shore train. And so it really makes a north, south, east, west system out of what right now is a single line rail system.
So thank you for sharing everything about the Westlake Corridor project. That'll do it for this edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I would like to thank my guest, Bill Hanna, who is president and CEO of the RDA. And I'm your host, Kevin Comerford. Thanks for joining us today.
You can hear part 2 of their conversation next week. Support for Building Northwest Indiana comes from the Construction Advancement Foundation. And you can hear Building Northwest Indiana right here on Tuesdays here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And the podcasts are also available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Well, first we lived near the beach here. We didn't have a lot of money, but we rented a basement apartment. David was born, and about that time Joe was drafted. And I had to move anyway, and I was living on the allotment was like $80 a month. It was very small. Because I was a war widow, they call us war widows, I got cheap rent, and I had one big room and a bathroom and a small bedroom. That's all we got. I don't think the project is there anymore. It's homes now, but I can remember the project was, you had to hang your clothes in the living room. There was no place. In the summer, you could hang it outdoors, but it was tough. They didn't make anything easy for anybody then. Well, David didn't go to work. He went to the old Miller School on Lake Street, you know. I think it's an art center now, but that's where he first went to school. But later, the population grew so much here in Miller that they couldn't meet there. There was no room. So they were meeting in what general office of the project. Some of the kids went to kindergarten there because the population had grown here in Miller. The attraction of the lake, this has always been the prettiest part of Gary. There were parts of Glen Park that were beautiful, but nothing like Miller. Miller has been, I wouldn't want to live any other place.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Lake Area United Way is working with other local agencies and groups to assist migrants who need help. Andrea Prubunicki with the Lake Area United Way was with us recently to explain the kind of assistance that's available to agencies from the federal government and other sources. First, how serious is the issue of migrants, assistance, that is, to migrants?
Well, that's a great question, Chris. And I know that from speaking anecdotally with a couple of different organizations that there are nonprofits in Lake County in Northwest Indiana who are working with migrants who have been released from the Department of Homeland Security. And they are simply awaiting for the go-ahead to get to work in our community. And so the Emergency Food and Shelter Program, which is actually federally funded, it is not a local funding source, it's a federally funded source, is offering an opportunity for any nonprofit, faith-based, or governmental agency that is working with migrants from the southern border, providing that humanitarian aid, the food, the shelter, the transportation, and health and medical services. They're offering the opportunity for those organizations to apply for funding to reimburse the expenses associated with that service.
When you have to approach agencies, of course, a lot of them I know are working, of course, with the Lake Area United Way right now because of the initiative that the Lake Area United Way has to try to reach out, in particular, to families as well as individuals that fit into the income bracket and wanted to help get them supported as well as help make their lives better by improving them, their education, their employment, and the like. How do the social service agencies that you all work with on this particular project help deal with these people who are in particular are not from this particular region? They may be from the southern part of the border around in Mexico or other Latin American countries.
Well, I think that there are so many nonprofits in Northwest Indiana that are helping people that are in poverty, that are one step above poverty, our Alice families, and that are working with people who have various immigration statuses. And so I want to be clear that the funding opportunity that I wanted to talk with you about today, Chris, is a federal opportunity for these agencies to be reimbursed. And United Way, in this instance, is really a facilitator for this grant process. And so this is not United Way funding. This is funding that we facilitate coming from the federal government into Lake County. And so any nonprofit or faith-based or governmental agency can apply for this competitive grant from the federal government. And to do that, what they would need to do is go to the Emergency Food and Shelter Program website. And I'm going to say it slowly, and hopefully you'll remind me to say it a second time at the end of our call today, Chris. It is the website that these nonprofits, faith-based organizations, or governmental agencies need to go to is EFSP, so that's E as in easy, F as in Frank, S as in sugar, P as in Peter, EFSP.unitedway.org. And when the organizations get to the website, right in the middle of the page is a yellow tab that says supplemental funding information. And on that site is all the information that a nonprofit or faith-based or governmental agency might need in order to make an application for these federal funds, reimbursing their emergency services for any migrants that they might be working with in the community. Our job as United Way is to facilitate the local board for the Emergency Food and Shelter Program. And so this local board is made up of representatives from Catholic Charities, Salvation Army, the Continuum of Care, the Lake County Prosecutor's Office. And we as United Way are facilitating that discussion. When agencies apply for this federal funding, Chris, they need to do so by March 16th at 10:59 p.m. And the application is online. And from that point, when they hit submit, our local board will review to confirm that it's an eligible organization and then submit that to the national board. The national board is then going to make decisions about how to disperse this funding for humanitarian aid for migrants who came from the southern border. They have $25 million that they are dispersing along the border, but they have an additional $5 million to help nonprofits, faith-based organizations, and governmental agencies who are serving outside of that southern border. And I do know that there are a few agencies up here in Northwest Indiana that work specifically to help people with that are immigrating into our community. These are folks that want to be here, that want to work and want to contribute to our community. And so they're helping and providing that food and shelter, transportation and medical services in order to keep folks healthy while they're awaiting that go-ahead to work.
Well, Andrea, thank you for spending time with explaining what the programs are all about and the support that is going out to migrants here in Northwest Indiana. And more information is on the Lake Area United Way website, I know, to be able to apply for these, follow the rules and regulations and all. And I hope that you have many more organizations, maybe new ones, that not only are continuing to support migrants in the region, but some new organizations that are willing to give it a try, too. Thanks very much for explaining things for us today.
All right. It's my pleasure, Chris.
Andrea Pruebonicki is the Vice President for Community Impact for the Lake Area United Way. The Department of Veterans Affairs just expanded its health care coverage of Vietnam War veterans who may have been exposed to the jungle herbicide Agent Orange to sailors who had served on vessels close to the coast during the war. There's also a big expansion of the list of medical conditions that are associated with Agent Orange as well. The Deputy Undersecretary for Field Operations, Willie Clark, is working on a major public information campaign these days to talk about the expansion of the assistance to make sure that all veterans who had served in Vietnam are aware that they may have been exposed. Will you give us a little background on some of the problems that members of the Navy have had? We're talking during the Vietnam era, actually during the Vietnam War itself, that seemed to be coming home, sadly to say, here in 2020.
This new law, the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Act of 2019, actually extends benefits to individuals that served within a 12 nautical mile area off the coast of Vietnam. If they were aboard certain vessels, of which we partnered with the National Archives and Records Administration to obtain over 28 million images of deck logs and the like. But previously, individuals, the Agent Orange Act didn't apply to individuals unless they had set foot on ground and then later within what was called a brown water area in certain inland waterways. Mm-hmm. But this new law, signed into effect by our president in June of last year, benefits effective in 1 January of this year. We've got especially trained individuals to do this work. As you know, Chris, thank you for your service, but over 57% of the individuals working with the Veterans Benefits Administration, including myself, are veterans. So we're happy about this opportunity to get the word out on your show and others to say, come in to us, and because there are a lot of benefits there, and this long wait is over. We thank you for your service. These are things you justly deserve, and we want to help file a claim.
One of the things I understand that with the changes that took effect on January 1st also included an expansion of the list of medical conditions that seem to be associated with Agent Orange. Tell us what the latest list includes, other than some of the things that we may or may not already know.
Well, there is this list. There are 14 diseases and disabilities that are extended Two, if an individual is diagnosed with them, we'll make sure and get a copy of that complete list. There are 14. I don't want to start because I might miss one. But things like diabetes, we've got lung cancer, we've got prostate cancer, and there are several others that are there for veterans. We need you to just come in to us, benefits.va.gov. Go in through your veteran service officer, your private attorney. Call us, 1-800-827-1000, 1-800-749-8387. And we're appreciative of shows like this that gets the word out, that allows our regional office directors to go out and conduct town halls and others, because it is vitally important that we get that word out.
Mr. Clark, do you think that there are some people that would hear us and hear of these lists that know me about the situation with Agent Orange, but maybe never thought, number one, that they might possibly have the disease or the symptoms that show up there, because maybe their doctor in the past hasn't found these or hasn't even noticed them?
Well, and that's true, and that's why it's important for them to come to us and shows like this, that we get that word out. If they're receiving treatment and those 14 disabilities, those diseases that I spoke to, alluded to, they're on the website, benefits.va.gov. Come in with medical evidence. If you have that, present to a VA hospital. And if you say that you want to receive treatment as a result of your service in Vietnam, they will provide free medical treatment. We're here for veterans, and we want to get the word out so they can come to us.
These vessels that you mentioned that you discovered over time, besides the usual ones that might have been used in the inland waters, like I guess what you could call PT boats, the small craft that get around fast and make it through on the rivers, the Blue River Navy obviously has bigger ships than that. What types of ships might veterans who are stationed on those ships that are close to the shore during the Vietnam War might possibly have been on? What bigger vessels are we talking about here?
Well, there's a long list of almost 2,000 vessels. So, again, I don't want to name them.
Right.
What we do want to do, though, is if veterans can remember what vessel they were on and the time period, come in to us.
If you don't remember,
come in to us. We've partnered with these agencies to get these records, and we will work with them to assist them to get their claim ready so we can make a decision on it.
Well, as we talk here, getting close to the 1st of March 2020, and then the program began first of the year, what kind of response have you gotten so far?
We've gotten great response, but we need to get the word out more. As you mentioned earlier, there's always certain number of folks that don't get that word out. And sadly so, a lot of veterans have passed on, so we're talking about survivors.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to continue to get that word out. That's what part of my being here, you're allowing me to come on your station, is about. So we need to just continue to do that.
Well, Mr. Clark, thank you for spending time with us talking in general. Again, go to the website, benefits.va.gov. Find out more about the expanded coverage into the problems that Agent Orange that was sprayed, of course, extensively during the Vietnam War, and how many more Vietnam War-era veterans might have been affected by this. And Mr. Clark, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Willie Clark is the Deputy Undersecretary for Field Operations with the Veterans Benefits Administration. There's an important collaboration that has just gotten started from Northwest Indiana. The Lake Area United Way is collaborating with Methodist Hospitals and with the help, some financial help from the organization, which is called Early Learning Indiana, is going to be able to create a collaboration which should address problems with health care here in the region, in particular in the city of Gary. With us to talk more about this collaboration and how it's getting started and what's going to happen eventually, we have the president and CEO of the Lake Area United Way with us, Lisa Daugherty. Lisa, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about the overall transition that the Lake Area United Way has been making in the recent years to try to help Northwest and Indiana, in particular Lake County's low-income families, and in turn how this new collaboration, a very important one, is going to fit in with it.
Chris, in a nutshell, we had announced 5 years ago that we were going to transition to a new model. We went out into the community and we identified a population called ALICE, which stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. These are folks who are working, but they're not earning enough to afford basic necessities. And in Lake County, we've got about 1 in 4 of our families that fall into that situation. You know, what's challenging for folks in that population is that because they're working, they're not eligible for public assistance. So in a lot of ways, they're more vulnerable than our folks in poverty. So, you know, when we identified ALICE, we again went back out into the community, talked to ALICE families, and we heard a few, you know, different themes, barriers that were extremely challenging for them. You know, the fact that they didn't have a safety net. You know, there's not enough housing stock that is affordable. You know, we all know that healthcare is an issue. You know, one area, healthy food is another. And then the two areas where we landed were on helping ALICE families access livable wage jobs and quality child care. Mm-hmm. And so this collaboration with Methodist is a perfect example of the types of new initiatives that we'll be working on, because we sought funding, and with that funding and, of course, the campaign monies that we raised, a small portion of those campaign monies, we are going to be able to put a path to level 3 quality child care center in the Methodist Northlake campus, which happens to sit right in a child care desert in, mm-hmm. in Gary.
I understand from Early Learning Indiana, their information shows on a statewide basis that more than 45% of Hoosier children live in a child care desert. Is that a higher percentage here in particular in Lake County because of our situation here?
Yeah, so the child care deserts are technically by census tract. And so we have three deserts in Gary. There's one in Crown Point. There's one in Whiting and Highland and Schererville. And what they mean by child care desert, technically, is that there are a lot of jobs, but there's not enough quality child care seats to provide child care for all the children that reside in that area as well.
It's quite a challenge, it sounds. We have families that certainly could have, I guess, could use the help. They're looking desperately with decent jobs to be able to find a place to be able to bring the youngsters so they're well cared for while they have their jobs and still can pick them up in the evening.
Yeah, we really see this as a two-generation approach because while, you know, helping families access better-paying jobs is a key focus for us. A lot of the families, you know, if they don't have that quality child care, they often choose to stay at home. So this strategy is going to benefit employers, you know, the parents, and of course, give the children a great start and have them ready for kindergarten when they're experiencing that quality child care.
Tell us a little bit about Tanika Davis. She is listed as the local child care provider that's going to help you all the most in getting this child care center set up at the Northlake campus.
Yeah, we have a work group that we're facilitating, one around jobs, one around child care. And the conversation that those groups started having was about, you know, looking for a partner that could provide the child care in an existing space and perhaps for an employer who was struggling with, you know, retaining, advancing employees because of child care. And Geminis Corporation participates regularly in that work group. And Tanika Davis, who runs Faith Childcare, was one of the first providers that they recommended consult with. She's got a couple of other childcare centers in Gary. She is a wonderful, wonderful woman, very excited about this project. this is a perfect collaboration to illustrate how coming together can make it happen. You know, Methodist isn't in the business of childcare, and employers who have looked to provide a childcare center on their properties, it's too expensive and it's out of their realm of expertise. Tanika Davis, who has the expertise, doesn't necessarily have the capital to renovate or put a facility in. So Lake Erie United Way, you know, convenes the partners, comes to the table with the funding. You know, Tanika is able to get started and actually sustain that child care center for years to come on her own. So we're essentially funding the initial, you know, renovation, perhaps some subsidies for families who might not be able to afford it, and then we're out and moving on to another important project. So it's really an ideal collaboration for us.
Tell us a little about the plans for this year, because I guess the goal is to have the child care center up and running at the North Lake campus by the end of the calendar year. So it sounds
Correct.
Like there's a lot of things that have to be done certainly in the meantime, and you're planning for, I guess, a very impressive operation. You want to get several dozen youngsters be able to be situated in there as time goes on this year.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons that the stars aligned on this project is that Methodist had what used to be an adolescent behavioral health unit that was currently not being used for that purpose. And so we already had a wing, so to speak, that had its own entrance. It has lots of rooms already. There's already a security system. There's an outdoor area that can be easily converted to a playground for the children. You know, so the renovation that we have to do really is limited to, you know, a couple of walls have to come down, a couple have to come up. We've got to put a little bit of plumbing in to accommodate the licensing requirements of the state for a pass to quality level 3 center. But because so much of, the building already, fits, the project, we're going to be able to move pretty quickly.
Now, obviously, childcare involves more than just from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and there'll be some after-hours care, I'm sure, that'll have to be provided. Does this give an opportunity to be able to allow that because of the setting that you're putting this in?
Absolutely. We actually, we intend, Methodist is a 24-hour operation, and they've got the security there. There is the activity. They've got employees who need to access. We actually, throughout the county, need more 24-hour care providers because we have a lot of shift work when it comes to manufacturing and healthcare in particular. So, we are gonna get the child care center up and running initially with about 40 seats. And we will continue to expand the hours so that minimally we're an 18-hour provider with the goal of becoming a 24-hour provider when the demand is there.
Lisa, take a minute and talk about how Early Learning Indiana fits into this. They had a competition, I guess, in a way, for organizations around the Hoosier State to be able to apply for the money that's available. I think they have a million-dollar pot, so to speak, that they're working with here to supply organizations like this one going on, this collaboration between Methodist Hospitals and the Lake Area United Way. In conversations with the folks in Indianapolis about this, you obviously had to explain pretty much like the business plan model that you're going to adapt everything to make it work. What were their thoughts about what's been happening up here in the region?
Well, they obviously, they specifically made the dollars available to initiatives that would benefit a child care, a technically child care desert area. So their intention is to make more child care available, whether it's a project like ours, where it's basically a new center in a desert area, or it's an enhancement that expands, more seats. We're really grateful this opportunity. I mean, this is a sizable grant that we're receiving, and we've had the idea. When the grant opportunity came up, we pulled the partners together to talk about, you know, whether this was realistic to do in the allotted time that early learning, you know, afforded. And all the partners agreed that it was a win-win-win. And we had to submit a letter of intent, which basically described kind of broadly, you know, the scope of the project. And that was accepted. They wanted to go further with that application. So then we had to provide more detail on it. And of course, all the partners had to demonstrate their commitment, you know, to making it happen. And here we are.
That is Lisa Daugherty. She is the president and CEO of the Lake Area United Way, talking about the collaboration that the United Way has now with Methodist Hospitals in creating a new child care center at the North Lake campus in Gary. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.